And so I wanted to ask you a couple of sorts of questions. You know, just maybe a broad philosophical sort of question to start things with, but then I wanted to also talk to you about some specific projects that you had worked on.
Okay.
So the philosophical question is really, do you have a what you say is a theory of production, what you think a producer's role should be, maybe shouldn't be, how invisible should he be, how non-intrusive or direct in how he intervenes into the recording process? How do you see that role?
Well, I see a producer. My job is to help an artist put what they do down and make their project, to do that. Mm-hmm. 10 years from now, nobody's going to care whether I produced it or whatever. They're going to look down and see, oh, there's a Daryl Dodds album, or there's Mary Chapin Carpenter's album, or there's a Dixie Chicks album. I love this record. You know, so it's my job today to make sure that these artists, where they are today, put that music down on tape the best that they can.
Okay.
And, you know, and wherever they are in their lives or wherever they're wanting to go, I have to help guide them and help put that down and get the right musicians, get the right engineers, and pull that off. That's my job.
Well, let's talk about the project with the Dixie Chicks. You won a Grammy for that last week, so
yes,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that was strange.
And was it?
Well, I mean, you just work really hard and, you know, making lots of records, and you always pour your heart into every record you make, and then all of a sudden somebody goes, oh, you win a Grammy, here, boom.
Yeah.
And you, it's kind of like, oh, wow, that's okay.
Now, that was in development for a while, right?
Yeah. That is, most record labels, and this is something I tried when I came here, most record labels, when they sign an artist, they want to sign the artist, and then within a year, they want to do some type of turnaround, or a year and a half, excuse me, and they want to put an album out. And I was a publisher for a long time. I worked for Combine Music, and then the entertainment company for Kaufman and those guys, and SDK and EMI, and my job there was to find artists way early on and take 2, sometimes 3 years developing the artist and helping them find, you know, a direction for themselves and helping them find the right music as a writer or as just an artist cutting outside songs, and taking our time until we had the total package done. And then when we had the total package done, it was my job to go shop it to record labels.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for years. So when I came here to work, when I said, hey, let's start trying to develop artists, it was not well received right off, because if you've had an artist signed to a record label for 3 years, even the record label looks around kind of going, well, who's that person that's been on our roster for 3 years, you know, that I've never heard? And the Dixie Chicks was like my first experiment at a record label developing an artist. I originally signed them in Austin, Texas. They had a different lead singer, and we started working out of a house, just sitting around in a circle working on music, and then the band itself kind of evolved into getting Natalie to become the lead singer, changing musical directions, trying to record some stuff and going, that's not really us, let's try this, you know, and them obviously playing all the instruments on their record. They developed as artists, as musicians, and they learned the process of recording. So when it did come for the time for them to make their own album, they were ready.
Uh-huh.
They knew what it was like to walk in a studio and record. They knew what it was like to listen for songs for their album. They weren't green. They had been through the development stages of doing this, and it was not like throwing somebody a curveball.
Gotcha.
And it happens a lot that we go out and we sign artists, and, you know, we expect them to just walk off of, you know, from playing in a club or whatever and throwing them in the studio with a budget and all these producers and musicians and songs, and we just expect that everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. And so I'm glad that the Dixie Chicks process worked, and now it just worked again. I signed a group here called Montgomery Gentry.
Mm-hmm.
Did the same process. One of our people that works here, Anthony Martin, he was assigned the project for a year and a half. All he did was guitar, vocals, find them songs, try to help them find their direction. And then we found him a producer, Joe Scave, who went in, cut the album after they had already you know, learned what it was like to be in the studio, learned what it was like to find songs, figured out who they were, and they're the, just last week, hit, they broke all R&R records and Billboard records for the first, the highest debut of a new artist ever.
Wow.
And people are, you know, kind of looking around going, well, where do these guys come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they came from, heavy, you know, finding them way early on, heavy development, and making sure they were ready before we put them on the launching pad.
At precisely a moment when the prevailing logic of at least the last few months has been, let's get rid of artist development forever.
So that would be the biggest mistake any record label could ever make.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the place that you want to cut back. That's the place you want to pour your resources into.
Yeah. Now, you've done several productions with Paul Worley, and how do you divide labor when you work with him, or perhaps with another co-producer? But let's take his case specifically.
They're all different with me, but with Paul, Paul is very, he is a very, what's the best way to put it? He, spur of the moment, go for the moment, very creative, very much musician side of the glass, feel that sort, and we both have very similar song sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more on the control room, as you would say, side of the glass. Go more the conservative, thinking everything out, making meticulous, making sure everything is right on that side. So I'm more the, as you would say, conservative, and he's more the liberal.
Okay.
If there was a way to explain it in producing.
Well, could you give me a specific example of how that plays out in the studio?
Okay, like when we're tracking. Paul is always playing. He's playing acoustic guitar, and he's a musician, and he's getting into it from a musician's standpoint. And then I'm sitting behind the console where the speakers are, listening to it as a record, more of a somebody listening to it at home as a record, and I'm going, hey, you know, I think we need to, you know, change this part of the song because it would make it more of a record. And Paul's on the other side going, hey, musician, you know, steel player, Lloyd Maines or whoever, I think you should play this lick here. It's like Paul's a band member, really, and I'm more of a, the, you know, he's like the session, you know, leader guitar guy. And
right.
I'm sitting on the other side from the more technical side going, we got to make this is sounding more like a record or it's not sounding like a record.
Yeah.
I don't know if that helped at all, but.
Yeah, it did help. Well, let's say one of the things that, that with your recordings, that you listen to them, you say, this is not a debatable issue whether this is country or not. There's steel on almost every one of them, for example. Do you find those players, or do you end up letting, guiding, helping the artist find those players as you work through budget issues?
Normally the producer finds those artists, and what I try to do is on every record that I produce, I try to use a different band for each artist. You know, I listen to the artist, I listen to their music, and they're paying, you know, part of my job as a producer is to help them put together a band for their album that sounds, when at the end of the day, sounds like them. You know, like if you listen to a Daryl Dodd album, it doesn't sound anything like a Mary Chapin Carpenter's new stuff that I just worked on, or it doesn't sound anything like the Dixie Chicks.
Mm-hmm.
Or it doesn't sound like Jim Lauderdale's album I did. It doesn't sound like any of those people. Each album should sound like the artist. It shouldn't sound like me. And I get a little, I mean, I'm just like anybody else that listens to the radio. Sometimes you listen to it and it all sounds the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my job to try to change that. It's my job for every artist that I work with that you listen to, for them to sound different than the next artist that's getting ready to come on right behind them on the radio.
Well, one of the things that's striking about that Jim Lauderdale recording you did is this amazing group of guest artists too. I mean, amazing, especially because of such breadth. You think of Ralph Stanley and Dia Davenport.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that happen?
Jim is a huge Ralph Stanley fan. He was raised. Jim's from the Carolinas area,
mm-hmm.
and Jim was a big bluegrass fan and had been working with Ralph for years, and that was all Jim's idea. He wrote the song. He called me up and said, "Blake, I got this song. I want to get Ralph Stanley to do it." We started looking at the logistics. Ralph was in town making this huge compilation album with all these huge guest artists. So, you know, they said, "While we're doing this, why don't you just come over and cut with Ralph's band?" It was really a cool moment for me, because I've never really worked in that type of music. Everything was cut live.
Oh,
everybody
yeah.
was playing in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
They both sang at the same time, looking at each other. It was a really cool thing. But that was mostly Lauderdale put that together.
Right. And so you certainly didn't have as many options on any kind of editing after that was done.
No. It was, we walked in, and Jim, actually, his version of how he wanted that I'll Lead You Home, he had a real slow kind of loping version of it. And Ralph goes, "Well, we've worked this up, Jim. Check out the way we've worked it up." And it was kind of an up-tempo, kind of trainy kind of beat thing. And that was pretty much the way we were going to do it. Because they worked it up that way. And,
right.
Yeah, that's fine with me. You know.
Well, let's say, like I mentioned, India Davenport and some other background singers are on there. Did they add their tracks later? That
yes.
wasn't done
yes,
live,
that was,
I wouldn't
that
think.
That was not done live. That
right.
was done later.
Yeah. And, because, I mean, her name struck me because I think I've got her on a rap album or two.
Right. She's an old friend. She's a friend of Jim's. I think, I'm not really sure the background. I think she was married or...
To Paul Weller.
The drummer, this guy from New Orleans that Jim knew really well, and that he played with, I think, Buddy Miller or something. And that's how that all came.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's maybe that Buddy Miller, New Orleans, Emmylou Harris...
Right.
Spy Boy connection.
I'm pretty much sure that's how that came about. I'm not for sure. She was great.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find I'm curious in returning to this notion of putting together a band that sounds like the artist, and really maybe this is almost more intuitive than anything else, but how do you decide whether you want to have let's say a Hammond organ, or whether you want to have an electric guitar maybe with certain effects, or whether you want to have mandolin?
That is just a gut thing. That's just from making records. Usually when I hear a song, like a person playing their song acoustically for me,
mm-hmm.
just singing it, when I hear it, I hear the record already in my head a lot of times. I hear a lot of the instruments or what I think something's going to go. I can actually hear a record being made in my head sometimes before I make it.
Okay.
And I don't know if I don't know if other producers, if that happens to them or not.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. That's just what happens to me.
Yeah. Well, you know what happens too when I write, I probably end up talking to more producers than most producers talk to, right?
I'm sure. It's weird. I was born and raised in this town, and I was always in the studio as a child growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched I've watched a lot of producers work, and as you say, most producers don't go watch other producers work.
Right.
And I've never seen two producers ever work the same.
Is that
close to the same?
Uh-huh.
Unless they were an engineer before, then they used to work for somebody else. Then you'll see them pulling out traits of the people they used to work for. But normally, you don't see that.
Yeah.
Everybody has their completely own different style.
What do you mean exactly? That's I'm really interested in pursuing that by a real different style. Do you see categories of style where you would say, okay, that's a type of style and this is a type of style?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's some producers that work from a more musical standpoint, being like, let's say you were asking me about Paul Worley.
Right.
My father is a producer. And I've only worked with him once in my whole life. But he and Paul and there's a few producers that work very musically. They're more concerned about getting in the musician part of making the record, the feel of it, the groove of it, which I'm way concerned with. But they come from a more musical strength.
Okay.
And then there's some producers that come from a more technical strength, that were engineers and know when a record sounds like you know, a record from coming out of the speakers and work from that end towards the other way.
Okay.
You know, so there's all kinds of different styles of producers. They're all right. Like George Massenburg works more from the engineering side.
Mm-hmm.
Kyle Lenning works more from the engineering side, even though he's a great musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then there's producers on the other end, you know, like a James Stroud was a drummer, musician guy. He works from that end. Tony Brown was a piano player, and he works more from the musical side back that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where, and so there, if you look down at different producers, you can always see where they kind of start from, and then they work the other way.
I see. Yeah. You think there are many producers in Nashville that would work from less? I think there are, and maybe like in jazz, for instance, there is. But I wonder in country music whether there are producers that work from a real historical point of view. They say this is the way, you know. Is the way, you know.
Chet Atkins.
Or yeah, or Lefty like, Frizzell would have been recorded
sure.
at.
Well, I mean.
Columbia.
Those are different styles of recording. A lot of that stuff was recorded all live at one time. It was recorded very sparse. Chet used to, you know, everybody sang their track. Everything was done at one time. Boom. You walked out the door and you had it in your hand. And, you know, some people have done that. I was listening to Vince Gill's new record, and it was done in a very Owen Bradley style to me. It had the big lush strings in the background, the real soft, airy background vocals, you know, groupy vocals and
right.
stuff. Yeah, and some people are going back and experimenting with that. I'm glad he did that. And I find that, you know, we go through cycles here in town where people use tons of reverb, people don't use any reverb, and all of that, and that's all part of the sound of records also, you know. It's a cycle thing. People just like to experiment. That's great.
Yeah, I would think in a case where you know the cycles are working, they always are operative, you end up having to decide at certain points, am I going to go with that or am I going to go against type right now, because that's always a possibility as well, I would think.
Whatever works for the artist at that particular time.
Uh-huh.
For instance, like the Dixie Chicks album, reverb doesn't work for those guys. They're real raw, in-your-face kind of records, you know, and when you listen to them on the radio, they sound a lot different than most things played before them and after them.
Right.
Which is, that's not bad. That's actually good.
Yeah.
It makes people stop and go, wait a second, that sounds different. What is that, you know, and that's part of the job also, is for us to get people's attention, so they'll listen to the music, and hopefully they'll go, wow, I love that, I want to go buy that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to do here.
Well, you produce Joy Lynn White's first recording, is that right?
Yes. So I did a couple of albums on her from here at Columbia.
At Columbia, right. Mm-hmm. How'd you get her as a person to produce? Did you sign her?
What happened was, we were talking earlier on about developing
mm-hmm.
people. I used to do a lot of demos, and I worked with a guy named Mike Henderson.
Yeah, I've got recordings by him.
And he said, what Blake, we need, we were doing demos just to pitch around to get songs cut. He said, I really need a really country female singer. And my best friend at the time, we'd gone to college with, was dating Joy. I'd gone to junior high and high school with. He's a great bass player in town. Said, I'm dating this girl that's a great country singer. You should try her out. And she came over and sang four or five demos, and like all of these songs got cut, and everybody started calling going, who is this girl? So when she got her deal at Columbia, they asked her, said, who would you like to produce your record? And she said, me.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, thank you, you know, and that's how that all kind of happened. She drugged me in.
And so I would assume, because you had heard her a good bit by that time, you had a pretty good sense of where you wanted to go.
Well, we had a style that we were doing with Henderson's songs. It was real Appalachian, very dry, very country, and very much in your face. As a matter of fact, a couple of songs that I cut on her for her albums, I've recut on the Dixie Chicks.
Mm-hmm.
The Dixie Chicks are a huge fan of her.
Oh, okay.
Natalie loves the way that Joy sings,
mm-hmm.
and that's great.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I guess, was she cut from the label or she just jumped ship?
She hasn't been here for a while. She did two albums and it just wasn't working out. And then she went and did an album on
She did one with that crew. She just did one with that crew out, Pete Anderson,
yeah,
Little Dog.
Right. She did an album with those guys.
Yeah.
It's okay. I listen to it. It's a pretty good record.
Right. Well, I would think, too, that her doing those demos kind of hooked her into knowing a little bit more about publishing and where she could pick up some songs,
she was singing everybody's songs, so she knew where they were.
Yeah.
And she also knew where to go get them. She's great. She's a great talent.
Now, in choosing songs and working out the repertoire, I'm curious, you know, how do you go about, do you check in with particular publishers, particular writers that you have real confidence in where you say, hey, you got anything you've been working on? How's that work?
Well, we have an A&R department here at Sony. We have three people that are always out looking for songs for our artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cliff Aldridge, Laura Putty, Anthony Martin, and they all are assigned different artists that they look for songs for. And then also, if I'm producing an artist, I go look for songs like any other producer does that are working. So there's a lot of people on the streets. Obviously, you can imagine the volume of songs that we've listened to just lately for the Dixie Chicks.
Well, yeah, once, and I'll bet you're just inundated.
Yeah, and Cliff has done a great. Cliff Aldridge is in charge of going through the songs with them and going to the publishers and that sort. And also, you know, they do write. So a lot of times if they're writing with Acostas or whoever, the artist, the writer will go, hey, I've got a new song, I want to play you. Boom, and they play it straight for the artist also. So we find songs from everywhere. You know, it's all, we just try to make ourselves accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Listening, and that's the key.
Mm-hmm. I was reading someone recently just talking about the way country music developed, beginning even in 1923 up until contemporary times, and they were
right.
They were making the point that, you know, if you think about blues is now a historical folk music.
Right.
It doesn't really sell, let's say, to African Americans in Mississippi. It sells to, you know, to people like me, 45-year-old men, and you know, who have record collections and such. But one big difference with country music is it has a folk base, but it's commercial, which
right.
is different than blues. And I'm curious about that kind of dialectic, that tension between, you know, one feature of your recordings is that they have this sort of, they've got their foot fully within country music, fully within a kind of historical stream, and then there's also the constraints of the marketplace. How do you balance those?
Well, I don't know. I don't think you consciously do that. I was raised here, and I laugh about it, but I grew up across the street from Maybelle Carter, and, you know, she started country music.
Right.
If it wasn't for her, none of us would have a job, but funny thing was, I didn't know, and I was little, I just knew she cooked a mean chocolate pie, you know?
Uh-huh.
And everybody that lived around me when I was growing up was in country music. Bob Moore, and who was part of the A-Team, lived behind me, and Lightning Chance, and then Brother Oswald's Backyard Touch Dyers, who was in Roy Acuff's band. And, you know, I just didn't know any better. All these people just lived around us, you know. Johnny Cash was Court and June right across the street, and it was just kind of a, you know, my mother listened to country music all the time.
Uh-huh.
She listened to George Jones and Tammy Wynette. Huge Glenn Campbell fan, and she just listened to stuff all the time, and you just hear it. I think it's a part of when you're growing up, get something hammered in your head enough, you learn where your roots are just by growing up. I didn't go to some library and learn about country music. I kind of grew up in it, you know.
Yeah. You just, and so you listen to it long enough. It's like other things in life. You just, right. it gets in your blood. You assimilate it.
But also, I listen to other types of music, you know. That Lauryn Hill record is incredible. The Wallflowers are incredible and all this other stuff. So you have to kind of, and then you look around at what you listen to and you try to make it all hodgepodge together. You know? That's another thing I love about Lauderdale. He knows more about country music that most people, you know, would give him credit for, but you listen to his melodies, and they've got, like, Beatle influences.
Yeah.
He's got all these different things, so he's kind of walking that line of bringing in, you know, the Ralph Stanleys and that guard, and bringing in, you know, this new stuff.
Now, when you listen to Lauryn Hill, this is perhaps an impossible question, but do you think you hear it as a producer, or do you hear it as a fan?
A fan.
Okay.
I mean, I always listen to production and stuff, but it seems like when I listen to records, even ones that I've produced later, when I listen to, you know, Daryl Dodd's album, I listen to it because I'm a fan.
Uh-huh.
That's why when I sign artists, I sign them because I'm a fan. And so you go through the whole process of making a record and working hard and listen to it as a producer and listen to it as a musician and listen to it as an engineer, but when you're done and you got it in your hand and you finally have gotten away from it long enough where you can see the forest for the trees and you pop it on, then you listen to it as a fan.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I really liked that recording you did with Stacey Dean Campbell.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Was it?
Yes, it was. And he's really good. I have no clue what he's doing right now, but he is a very talented man.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I just really like that kind of hard honky-tonk approach. Now, did you bring, that's Al Anderson on that, is Big Al of NRBQ, is that
like
right?
I'm like the biggest NRBQ fan walking.
Are you?
Oh, God, when I was a kid, when I was 14 and working in bars and sneaking around and stuff, every time, they came to Nashville twice a year to play, and then they would go do the Opry while they were here because the bass player, Joey Sapin, what is his name? Joey Sapinelli?
Right.
He was married to Skeeter Davis.
Yep.
So they would come down here, do a show, and then they'd go do a show with Skeeter over at the Opry. That's how they would, their reasoning for coming to Nashville. I believe I saw those guys at least, you know, 6 to 8 times. They slay me.
Yeah.
They literally, you could tell they were having a blast playing live, and their music showed. Really cool.
Yeah, they're great. They were, well, I don't think they exist in the same form anymore. I think Big Al left. But,
yeah, he left. I think they were talking about doing some kind of reunion show. I'm not sure. But back then, it was just incredible. And that's what I love about listening to Al's music. It always makes you smile. It's the same thing with Dennis Lindy.
Uh-huh.
You listen to his music, it always makes you smile.
Yeah. I love that blend. You know, they could go from Thelonious Monk to, you know, this rockabilly stuff on Telecasters. You know,
right.
That was what was cool about it.
I agree.
So did you suggested bringing in Big Al to Stacey Dean?
Well, yeah, Stacey had actually been writing with Big Al, and I think they wrote that song together, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for sure because I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah.
But Big Al does the thing that nobody else can do. Kind of like Mike Henderson, guitar-wise, does a thing that nobody else can do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want it, you got to bring them in to do it.
Right.
And so part of that song is it, what was the song with that done?
Yeah, I don't.
I can remember Big Al's part. It's been so long.
Right, I can't remember either. I've actually got the track listing in front of me, 8 feet high. While you've been gone so long, I can dream Midnight Angel, Hurt City, Pop Top. Sometimes she forgets, Honey, I Do, Mind
Honey,
Over
I
Man.
Do, that's
Honey,
it.
I Do.
And the big part of the song was Big Al's guitar hook.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he has this dumb way of playing. It's very dumb, but it's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I don't mind you putting the dumb part in there because he'll get a kick out of it.
He'll understand.
He'll completely understand. It's very dumb, and it's really cool, and it was the big hook of the song.
Yeah. Well, I love the way he bends notes, too. I mean, he's really all over the neck of that guitar.
He sure is.
Yeah. I think he ended up working with Carlene Carter.
Yeah, he did. That was a good... He was on the road with her for a while, too. Wrote a bunch of bunch of the songs on her albums too.
Yeah. Well, listen, you've been a great help to me. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Me too.
Yeah, very much. And good luck with, you're working with Mary Chapin Carpenter now, you said.
Well, I just did, like, a couple of sides for her greatest hits. Mm-hmm. I've been an old friend of, I was her publisher years ago. And so she just for her greatest hits, I went in with her to do a couple of sides, and it was a lot of fun.
I bet.
It came out really good. I'm really proud of it. Now I'm getting ready to go back home. We're rehearsing for the next Dixie Chicks album at my house. So
are you?
They're all at the house waiting for me.
Okay.
I better head that way.
Okay, well, I'm going to let you go then.
Okay, man.
Thanks a lot, Blake.
All righty, peace.
Bye.
Bye-bye.